Why go to all the trouble of experiencing the great outdoors for yourself when you can listen to a few Northwest Outdoor experts yap about it? This is The Outdoor Line with Tom Nelson, Rob Ensley, and Joey Pyburn on 710 ESPN Seattle and the 710 ESPN Seattle app. The Outdoor Line is brought to you by Yamaha, Sportco Outdoor Emporium, Lowrance, Weldcraft and Duckworth Boats, Roy Robinson RV, Kitsap Marina, Harbor Marine, and Ray Marine Electronics.
Hello, good morning, and welcome to the Outdoor Line of 710 ESPN Seattle, streaming live on MyRequest.com. Don't forget the live video feed on 710Sports.com, and of course, the venerable TheOutdoorLine.com with blogs, videos, podcasts, and so very, very much more. Good morning, Bob Buchanan of Bo-Mac.com.
Thomas, how are you today?
Good, buddy. Good to see you. Thanks for stepping in.
Awesome. Great to be here.
So, Robbo and Joey are back in Montana. I got to take my my little elk hunting hiatus back there and actually kind of back the same neck of the woods that they are. I couldn't help but noticing their gear list though. I know they both own tents, okay? Uh-huh. But they went back and they only brought one tent.
No way.
Yeah. So I don't know what's going on with that.
It's all about warmth.
Yeah.
Warm.
It hasn't been that cold. It just started kind of raining back there. But no, Robbo actually texted me last night. He's got one of those little in-reach deals they don't need to sell. But Robbo's got a beautiful big 4-point down, and then they got it packed out. And Joey, I think, is probably going to go ahead and tag out today. And so they'll be back for Thanksgiving. Certainly be back in the studio next week. But nothing but success and safety for my brothers. Get them back here for Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is maybe my favorite of the holidays. You know, I mean, I get a kick out of watching Kathy and the kids come to the door for Halloween and that kind of stuff, right? And Christmas is wonderful. Don't get me wrong. I love Christmas. Kids love Christmas. But there's just so much stuff, right,
yeah,
around Christmas. Thanksgiving, it boils it all down. You know, you're going to have family over. You're going to cook them a great meal. You get to share some of the stuff that you've taken in over the year. I mean, if there isn't some smoked salmon and some,
right,
you know, deer salami or elk salami or something going on at my place, folks are going to be really, really ticked.
It's going
right?
to be about 10 plates out with a yeah, sort of goodies.
No kidding. But, you know, I mean, we hunt pretty hard during the season, and Thanksgiving is kind of all over, you know, and so it you're kind of thankful for that too. So, you know, I mean, Thanksgiving's one of my favorites, and I know you look forward to it too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My salmon season got cut a little short.
All right.
A little shorter than I wanted, and I can't help it.
No.
I just can't help it.
All right. So let's talk about that, because, you know, we had a good opportunity in Area 11, and people were doing pretty doggone well.
Yeah.
We kind of started being uncomfortable when we heard the test fishing boat, which what WDFW has to establish some baseline, some population numbers, right? And so there, when the test boat comes out, they can get an idea of the relative abundance of sublegals and all the other, you know, so they're looking for legals, clipped fish that are sublegal. They're looking for legal fish. They're looking for unclipped fish and unclipped sublegals and unclipped. So there's a bunch of different categories that they're looking through. So they started test fishing about a week before anybody mm-hmm. else was in the water. And so, mm-hmm. I don't know what the normal or usual approach is on the Area 11 fishery, but my understanding was they usually did it closer to, if not concurrent with, the legal season for everybody else out there.
Right, right. I would only hope that those numbers from that week before gave them an idea of what was out there and what was going to be available, but they did not count and did not take those and throw them into a model that modeled our fishery a week later, that started a week later, because there was definitely a difference in the fishing the week they were out versus opening week.
100%. And so for a couple different reasons. You had way nicer weather, okay? You had a different tide set, but, you know, and there's no debating that as soon as you get a bunch of downrigger balls and a bunch of marine electronics
yeah.
pinging on those fish out there, it
yeah.
changes things.
It changes
and,
everything.
And does so profoundly. I just want to harken back for a minute to Marine Area 7, the San Juans, mm-hmm. which sticks to me like a burr in my saddle.
Oh, boy.
And I'm not the only one, obviously.
Yeah, imagine, I'm belly aching about only getting 3 days. So, good Lord, those poor guys.
So, but let's harken back here. When WDFW did not have an on-the-water sampling boat during that fishery, for whatever reason, it's not debatable. It's a fact. They did not. And so their their harvest estimation took place completely on the dock. So the dockside data completely governed that fishery. Now we go to the Marine Area 11 fishery, where they do have a test boat, and they're conducting dockside surveys concurrently. During a WDFW conference call, the comment was made that, well, we disregarded the dockside data because it was too far away from what we were seeing on the test boat data. Well, in my experience with statistical analysis, you need to take several different looks, several different types of sampling to come up with a true picture. So when you disregard the dockside data, because
you can't,
not from a correct sampling regime, that's not how it works.
Right.
You take it and, you know, I don't like this data. Well, you know what? It's data. Okay. And whether or not you think guys are being straight with you, that's what your samplers are coming back to with. And so just to disregard that data. So now you got Marine Area 7, which was shut down with just dockside data, okay, because it was good enough to shut it down. But the dockside data down here wasn't good enough to keep the fishery open. I struggle with the narrative, right? I really, really do, especially when I'm talking to a lot of guys, you know, down in Marine Area 11. Like, and so basically, what did we get? Did we get a week?
Of
in Marine Area 11?
Oh, we got more than a week.
Okay,
I mean,
10
we
days.
Had November 1.
November 1, okay,
yeah.
All right. So basically, so we ended up getting
just shy of 3 weeks.
3 weeks, yeah,
just,
okay.
Just all shy, right. But of that, you know, half of it was unfishable.
That's just it.
And you've got a third of it that had current conditions and everything else that were not favorable for the type of fishery that is down
but
there.
But that's my point, is fishable days.
Right.
You maybe got seven,
you,
eight, nine.
You got a solid 7 to 10
seven,
days.
10 days.
Somewhere in there.
When it wasn't storming, flooding, blowing,
right.
You know. Freshwater lid,
right.
Logs floating through the, you know.
The last 2 days, I know there was at least a dozen boats out there, both days, all with very good fishermen on it. I heard of two fish.
Yeah, yeah. So,
and it's that change from, you know, and last week at this time, it might have been 12 fish on the tide.
Right. So we're not going to, you know, We everybody anticipated this fishery would. Right. I mean, this is your winter season in Marine Area 11,
and it's
over.
And keep in mind that these folks that work these test boats, I mean, I watch them all summer long. Their boat's tied up three stalls from mine.
Yeah,
they're down there at daybreak and they're finishing up in the late afternoon. They work their tail off.
They do,
and they do a great job. It is not their fault. Someone sent them out there the week before to get that. Just hope they did not use that data to shut our fishery down.
Yeah, that's just it. So anyway, we've got a couple calls this week. We're a lot of the folks, and we may even have Carl on the show. Carl Nyman, in particular, you know, sits on the Puget Sound Wreck Fish Advisory Board that I work with as well. And he made the point, look, we need to take a look at this Area 10 fishery before we get started on this, because we don't want a similar issue. Now, part of it is, you know, we've got some smaller numbers. We're not going to belabor the point, but the WDFW rule change came out that actually closed the Area 11 fishery down yesterday. Right now, we're looking at a January 1st opener in Marine Area 10. The prevailing thought right now is maybe we delay that a little bit and let some of these sublegals that were indeed one of the key components in shutting down the Marine Area 11 fish and get that part out there. So anyway, the other, you know, huge news this week that was just absolutely inescapable was the near historic floods that we suffered in all marine areas, you know, here and all our river systems, and we're gonna dig into that a little bit more next segment. And you know, it was such a bummer because we had the beginnings of an amazing snowpack, which unfortunately set the table for the Pineapple Express to come in, and that's when you get the double whammy. You got all the snow in the mountains, all this early snow, which all us hunters pray for, and then you get this weird warm weather Pineapple Express, which is uncommon for a La Nina year. And if that snow would have stayed up in those mountains, and if the profound spawn that we had in our rivers would have stayed in place, we had a chance, you know, to really take off on a wild fish rocket, right?
Springboard off that and really get it rolling.
Bingo. Now we're gonna get a snowpack, but we're gonna dive into that later. But in the meantime, we got a show for you. Yeah. We got a show for you. My dear friend Ray Gombisky of JG Murphy is gonna jump in. He's got a couple young kids. He's doing a great job bringing those up. He's got some kind of thoughts about bringing some young hunters into and doing so successfully, and his sons are really going to enjoy that. And also, he's going to talk to us a little bit about Sportsman's Cove Lodge in Southeast Alaska. Of course, Raymarine Picks of the Week following that. Then, I tell you what, if there's some folks that have a way to save a couple bucks on their boats, and one of the way they do that is maintenance. Of course, the Pacific Marine Exposition is going on today, and Lauren Bivens is in his booth there at the PME from Harbor Marine. He's going to talk to us a little bit about winterizing and off-season accessorizing. Again, he's down there at the Pacific Marine Exposition, which is right over here at Lumen Field Event Center. Then the fishery in the state right now is that Hood Canal chum fishery.
Absolutely.
It is a kick in the pants. All these chums stage at so many of those streams that are coming into the magnificent Western Washington fjord that is Hood Canal. And you know, Kelly's got a pretty cool program to catch them, you know. He bobber fishes them, he jigs them a little bit, but also he's going to talk to us about that and the Black Friday fishing event. So yeah, definitely looking forward to that. So we got a great show for you. Hit that text toy up, 206-421-3776. That's that text toy powered by Yamaha Outboards. 866-979-3776 is the Reverse Giant Hotline, brought to you by Wellcraft Duckworth Northwest Boat. Okay, so from the 206, one of our early texts, here we go. Any idea on what the flooding events over the last week will do to the eggs in the rivers in Western Washington? Should we expect a pretty big drop in smolt production in the Skagit, Sky Green, and other rivers will hit with major floods? That's a great question, which we're going to answer in 90 seconds right here on the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN. Seattle.
From the shining shores of Puget Sound to your radio, this is the Outdoor Line on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Welcome back to the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN Seattle. Bob Buchanan stepping in. It only takes one Bob to replace a Robbo and a Joey.
That's right.
It's just all it takes. Matt Nelson behind the glass. I'm Tom Nelson. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Again, hit that text toy up. That's 206-421-3776. And lots of questions, including the one we just came into this segment with, which is, you know, hey, what's the effect of these floods? Well, first off, let's talk about the life cycle of the salmon just for a minute here to all get on the same page. We could just kind of need to agree on a couple things. Mm-hmm. And one of those things are, you know, salmon spawn in the gravels of our rivers and streams. The bigger the fish, the more the heavier rocks they can move and the tougher their eggs are, okay? The tougher their nests are, and the more protection they afford for those eggs. So there's when you have a phenomenal disturbance of the habitat like we just did, and you have a whole bunch of sediment moving downstream, you not only scour a lot of those eggs out of the gravel, you entomb them in silt and sand, and that's it, game over. Once you stop that incubating flow of oxygenated water over those eggs, they're done. They're all done, and so. So physically, then you've probably covered them up. In addition, the fish that are in the water right now have not yet spawned, are subject to a pretty significant pollution event because all that water that came across the roads and agricultural fields and people's houses and stuff like that, all that stuff is not meant to be directly in the water. Microplastics, hydrocarbon petroleum products, all that kind of stuff, fertilizers, stuff that was whatever, right? All that stuff gets in the drink and it's not good news, right? And then there's something of a thermal disruption too, because it just messes up the temperature regimes in your streams. And you would like those eggs in the gravel in a consistent temperature, right? It's a mess. Okay. Right. So now there's certain groups out and about that are anti-hatchery groups. Okay. In an event like this, if you back off on your hatchery program at the same time you have a flooding event, what do you have?
You've got a recipe for not much fishing.
You got
two,
no
three,
fish.
4 years down
you
the
have
road.
No fish. You have no fish. So before anybody gets behind one of these anti-hatchery groups that are out there, and there's a couple of them out there, okay, and I don't need to name them. You need to understand the significance, the importance, and ultimately the necessity of Washington State's hatchery program. And let's no, there's no doubt there were some heroic WDFW folks out feeding fuel into generators and sandbagging, because, you know, according to the last I heard from Edward Eliezer, we made it through a lot of our hatchery programs, a lot of our hatchery, even though there's floodwaters coming up to them, we didn't get a big hatchery failure this time around. Thank God. Yep. Okay. Because, like one of my old mentors, Russ Arell, who was a fisheries biologist for years, told me, you know, during a previous flood, probably 20, 25 years ago, he goes, look, Tom, if we didn't lose them this time around in this flood, then we'd never lose them, right? Well, we lost a lot of humpy eggs, for sure. Yeah. We lost a lot of Chinook eggs. There's still a bunch of coho swimming around, and there's still a bunch of chum swimming around. But, again, you know, now you kind of talk about this pollution event, the fact that spatially they're displaced because you had a bunch of coho swimming through freaking pasture fields and that kind of stuff. It's, you know, so it's a bad deal. It's a really bad deal. So why are hatcheries the answer in this situation? Because, look, you can take less fish in a hatchery situation and make more than the wild fish can in the wild, and here's why. There's three critical phases to a salmonid egg's development, okay? They've got to get fertilized, they've got to get put in gravel and incubated, and they have to hatch successfully, okay? When you have fish in a hatchery situation, instead of only 10, 12, 13% of the eggs actually getting effectively fertilized, you fertilize it in the 90 percentile because you're taking
right.
the eggs, putting them in a bucket, okay, getting them out. You know, I've done this.
Yeah,
right?
I've watched it.
So you're getting a really high percentage of those eggs fertilized. Wonderful. Okay, so you're saving, there's like, instead of 10, 12%, now you're getting 90% through that critical phase. Then you got these eggs in incubated trays because they're protected in these trays, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you got water flowing down through them. They got a wonderful little, you know, incubating flow in
great,
there.
Great temperature.
Then they'll go in there and physically shock the eggs because any kind of movement will cause the eggs to become opaque if they're not alive, right? And so some of those eggs that aren't viable will cause fungus in the rest of that nest. Get rid of those, okay? And then they have to hatch, and they have a yolk sac in the bottom, and they button up, okay? So if you're carrying all these eggs through these critical phases and doing them, and they get through these in the 90th percentile of survival rather than the 90th percentile of failure, mortality,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're getting a way higher percentage of those eggs out of the hatchery environment than you can out of the wild. Now, why are the wild fish important? Because they give you your genetic variability, dude. We need the problem with hatcheries are if you take the same fish coming back to the same facility all the time, you get a bunch of cousins, right? Mm-hmm. So they all come back at the same time, and they come back at the same size. So then one event can wipe a whole bunch of these critters out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we need the genetic variability of our wild fish populations. And so we've changed hatchery practices a tremendous amount. But the concept, the fact, and the thinking that there's folks out there that are suing WDFW to keep hatchery programs out of there, where's the compelling evidence that these anti-hatchery folks have ever saved a single fish? And all they've ever done is increase their savings account from suing the state, right? So, again, if you have any inkling that these floods were not good for our salmon populations, then you know you're halfway out the anti-hatchery door. You don't need me, right?
Right.
I mean that, but that's the deal. So we won't belabor that point. But let's be smart with who we support, you know. And Hatchery Wild Coexist is definitely an outfit we should support. Okay, these days,
yep.
You know, Fish Northwest has an aggressive stance on stuff as well. You know, Puget Sound Anglers. You know, I struggle with some of the stuff they do, but, you know, NSIA, you work with NSIA a tremendous amount.
CCA, there's a lot of folks that do a lot of wonderful things. We might not all agree every single time
right.
on everything, but by God, we know marking fish and having hatcheries is job one.
I tell you what, that's it too. And again, all you have to do is look at the orca population dynamics and look at the same time we cut our hatchery fish and look what happened with the orcas, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We need to produce fish, and that's, you know, and so we've got folks like the Pacific Salmon Commission that have an initiative now that are going to increase hatchery plants in the state of Washington by up to 20 million smolts, okay? And I'm just glad we got some of that stuff ramped up before we had an event like this.
And now, it's going to be in this infrastructure program that's going on back in D.C. It's going to be interesting to see just what comes out of that for us here.
And there is a bunch. And that's something that we're gonna dig into next week as well. Yeah, no question about it. All right, we're going to pop out here for a quick break. Coming back at you with a BOMAC Tech Line. Ray Gombiski, MurphyAuction.com, going to jump in. He's been out doing the waterfowl thing, doing so with the boys. Talk to us a little bit about Sportsman Cove Lodge in Southeast Alaska. Ray Gombiski joining us next here on the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN. Seattle.
Welcome to the BOMAC Tech Line. BOMAC has all the gear for all your techniques, and SMI Shellfish gear is simply the best. BOMAC, we catch big fish.
We got Bob Buchanan from BOMAC sitting right next to me. Matt Nelson behind the glass. I'm Tom Nelson on the phone. My old friend Ray Gombiski, J.G. Murphy, and so much more. Good morning, Ray. How are you, buddy?
Good. How are you, Tom?
Doing good, man. Doing good. It's been a little bit too long, but I can't help but notice You're bringing up a couple young hunters these days and doing a great job. So how old
are the boys?
Yeah, how old are they?
The boys are 7 and 9.
7 and 9.
And, you know, when the hatchery steelhead thing kind of went away locally here, I got back real hard into bird hunting, and the kids came along, and now they're like little bird dogs.
That's awesome. That's,
so with shot collars or just hip boots? No, hey, dude, it's a difficult deal to get some kids into it. And you're doing just a great job. So, you know, if there's a couple of fathers and mothers out there that want to kind of do this, give us some pointers, give us some tips. How would you get a kid
into it? One thing that I started with the boys is whenever it's not fun, we just leave.
Yeah.
So if it's cold or wet or rainy. Another thing I started doing early on with them was my wife would bring them down to the duck blind about 10 o'clock.
Oh, there we go.
So they get about 2 hours of hunting, pick up, they get pictures with the birds and feel like they were part of the great day. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right on. And they help you pick up the decoys.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That's part of the deal. Hey, you let them drive the four-wheeler around, they'll pick up all the decoys, I promise.
That's perfect. That's absolutely perfect. So basically, doing fields, that's kind of your jam, upriver, not messing around with tidal waters or stuff like that generally, right?
Yeah, normally we're in harvested cornfields or grass silage fields. You know, I have mostly the Snoqualmie Valley. I do jump into Skagit a little bit, but pretty fortunate to have grown up in this area my whole life and hunted these birds. You know, one thing I've noticed over the last couple of years, it seems like our bird numbers are just going up and up and up, especially with the dart geese. I don't know if you guys have noticed that up north there, Tom, but, man, they're everywhere.
Yeah, we've got honkers and up, you know, like crazy, and this year we got a profound snow goose flight as well. I'm hoping to dig into those a little bit more next month. But basically, I love your approach because – you're keeping it fun for the kids. You're staging your hunt in an area where, listen, if they don't want to sit in the blind, they can go run around and do stuff and kind of keep them busy. So, dude, that is absolutely so cool. So what has this recent flood done to some of your famous and better duck hunting areas?
Well, it's redistributed the feed and the birds a little bit. You know, anytime you have a big flood like that, it'll float all the feed to the surface. And it just gives the birds a ton of options. So they don't have to come to your decoys to eat. It's been pretty warm out, so they're not in that chomp mode. So when you know that water's in the valley, you know the birds are just kind of bouncing around to wherever they feel like. Now things are starting to drop again, and I think by Sunday here we should start hunting pretty good again.
Gotcha. All right. Well, your position with J.G. Murphy Company has brought a real interesting and compelling property to the block. So tell us a little bit about AlaskaBestLodge.com, also known as Sportsman's Cove Lodge, Ray.
Yeah, Sportsman's Cove Lodge is on the east side of Prince of Wales Island, so it's a very protective lodge. And Matt came to us. He's the owner up there. He came to us about 6 months ago, and he says, you know, I'm 80 years old. It's time to retire. And he wanted us to help him sell the lodge. And so that's what we're in the process of. It's a 30-bed, first-class, first-cabin operation with five little Hoquiam charter boats. And he's offering it for sale as a complete operating entity. And for more information, you can go to MurphyAuction.com. But it truly is one of the more first-class facilities in Southeast Alaska.
Yeah, it's a killer location. Like you said, it's really protected. It's kind of the other side of the island from Robbo's operation. But yeah, he knows he was actually shocked when he heard this was an opportunity for somebody. It's just absolutely insane. Since you mentioned our winter steelhead, which, you know, dude, when we first started doing this show, if it was the week before Thanksgiving, we were going through our steelhead hatchery plant numbers and licking our chops, Ray.
Yeah, we were, weren't we?
Oh, boy.
What a sore subject that is.
Well, so go ahead. I mean, explain, you know, I'm not going to ask you an explanation why, but it's just this used to be one of our absolute opportunities that we couldn't wait for. In fact, there was a time where winter was my favorite time of year because just...
Yeah, you know, I mean, I grew up on our hatchery steelhead, and by God, Tokel Creek put out some great fish for
a
lot of years. And in 2000, well, really, it started in the late 90s. This outfit called Washington Trout came along and, hey, these hatchery fish are bad. And by 2008, they got rid of our summer end plant, and they were, you know, cheerleaders. Hey, this is going to help our summer end. And, you know, here we are 14 years and four generations of steelhead later, and it didn't work. I don't know what else to say. The reduction in hatchery plants, at least on that summer run system, or summer run plant and the Snoqualmie, didn't work. And it's reducing the winter fish isn't working for the wild fish either. You know, hatchery fish are an opportunity fish that are bought and paid for by sportsmen. And when they're gone, my boys are not going to see a hatchery steelhead, and they're not going to fall in love with it and go chase and protect those wild steelhead. And I think that's my concern right now is they don't even know what one looks like.
Yeah, keeping that interest up.
Yeah. So you're right, Tom. This was my favorite time of year, and now it's duck hunting season. You know, it's a shame to see. I hope that at some point we can use hatcheries as a tool in the Puget Sound system to help recover these steelhead. Right now, some of the EISs that have been put forth don't really include a lot of brood stocking or hatchery use to help recover wild steelhead. And there are places where that is a great tool, and hopefully the state can at some point look at some sort of brood stocking that we'll bring our wild fish numbers back up.
And I was involved in a brood stock program up in the Skagit years ago. It was unquestionably a successful program. Right now we've got, you know, guys like Matt Chandler working on the chums on the Skykomish. Okay, that's a brood stock program that's starting to see some results as well. It's just that, you know, like you mentioned, hatcheries are a tool, and if the tool is not doing the job that you need it to do, you don't blame the tool. You use the tool differently. And you know, right. And I don't know if you're listening to the last segment or not, but, you know, when we have a major environmental disturbance like we just had with these floods, if you don't have hatcheries backing up these wild fish, because, you know, look, if you don't think this flood has reduced the natural spawning success in our local streams, then you're not paying attention.
Yeah, no, I mean, the floods are, you know, they're not only are they're bigger right now, the floods in the spring are more frequent. And I really think that affects our smolt out migration and will force all those little fish out very quickly in the spring. And I think that's oftentimes undercalculated. You know, when you get a May flood, that can really push a bunch of smolt out, and then all the predators get a hold of them. So our weather does have an impact. You know, fall floods are especially hard on coho and pinks, but they can affect all run segments. And, you know, it's something where a hatchery program could supplement that with a good broodstock program. I think you see it a lot down in Oregon and on the Columbia system as well.
Right. Yes, you do. And they're successful. So, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll get some, hopefully get some progress that direction. Ray Gombiski, Murphy Auction, and of course, go check out Alaska's Best Lodge. Excuse me. Alaska'sBestLodge.com and MurphyAuction.com. Ray, good job on getting those kids out on those duck blinds, and keep in touch, my friend.
Thanks, Ray.
All right, guys. Take care.
All right, buddy. Take care. All right. Coming up next, Raymarine Picks of the Week for the weekend before Thanksgiving right here on the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN, Seattle.
Welcome to the Outdoor Line Picks of the Week, presented by Raymarine Electronics. Don't just go fishing, go hunting underwater. Raymarine, simply superior.
Head over to raymarine.com. You're going to find the all-new Cyclone Open Array Marine Radar, a high-power, solid-state marine radar system. The Cyclone is there to keep you going in some heavy-duty weather. Go check it out at raymarine.com. Also, the Pacific Marine Expo kicks off. Actually, today is actually the last day of the Pacific Marine Expo at Lumen Field Event Center. And our buddy Raymarine Mike Sirdick is going to be right there answering your questions. You ever go to the PME?
I used to. I used to be in the commercial industry somewhat. The firm I worked for did both commercial and sport, and I'd get over it. It's quite a show. I recommend anyone has the time today to get down there and look at it. You'll see some stuff.
Oh, definitely.
It's just amazing.
Yeah, you know, safety gear, bigger stuff in general, but you're still going to learn a few things. And, I dig going on there seeing the bigger transducers and stuff. You know, because you learn a few things from the professionals
tricks of the trade out there. There's some guys that know a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that is for darn sure. All right, so check it out. You got the week before Thanksgiving here. Now, local rivers are having a little bit of a tough time right now. We've covered that ad nauseum. I'm done talking about that. But we're actually going to have Kelly Reardon on next hour and talk about that Hood Canal Chum deal. Now, I was going to run down there this week, but the sounds a little full of drift right now.
A little woody.
For a 60-mile run, yeah. So, but that'll probably happen next week. But the cool thing about that is he's been fishing anchovies dyed green or blue underneath a float.
Under a float.
And they come and just rail it.
Hammer it.
Yeah. So spin a gear, 30-pound test, you know, flick that bobber out and just kind of float along with it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to mess around with that in the kelp this summer for Chinook too.
Yeah.
Just, you know, using a whole herring and maybe just a firecracker herring and just float that stuff on. I mean, that would definitely work in some of the stuff that you can't really troll next to. And it's definitely something I'm going to play with a little bit. Razor clams on the coast. You got that going on there.
No.
By the way, I may have a damaged clam tube for you.
I think I know where we can get another one.
Yeah, ran that sucker right into the rocks. Yeah. Tell me about Marine Area 10 crab this week.
That's firing up real quick.
In Tuesday.
In fact, I'm, if everything feels good Tuesday, I'm coming off post-surgery here, but everything feels good Tuesday, I'm going to come over and work that Kingston shoreline a little bit.
So give me a clue. Give me depths. Give me bait. Give me some thoughts about that. About Area 10 crabbing.
We'll get over there and we'll start the pots at probably 50 feet in every 20-foot increment. We'll drop three of us. We'll drop six, and we'll actually pull them pretty quick. A half an hour. We'll probably get the six down and turn right around and start pulling and find where they're at, and then pepper that depth.
Okay.
Along the shoreline.
So you're the one that kind of got me hip to the concept of fast fishing pots and slow fishing pots for both shrimp and crab.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're out there testing and you haven't been out there for, you want a fast fishing pot.
Right.
What's a fast fishing crab pot?
Well, you want one of the collapsibles. Or a fast fishing pot is one that has a gate down low and no ramp.
Gotcha.
So that they can quickly get around that pot, whether it's round, square, rectangle, octagon, whatever. Get it down there so it's floor surface and they can get right in and get after it. And some folks feel that they crawl out of that. If you got bait in there, they're not leaving. They're going to hang around and just live with that bait until they're done eating it.
The collapsible pots get a bad rap.
They do.
Because guys fish them without added weight and on short pieces of floating yellow poly. And so you'll see these collapsible pots floating in the middle of the channel because if you don't have any weight in one of those collapsible pots, they're pretty light, right? And a single crab float will pick them up and move them.
Right.
Especially if you're fishing yellow poly.
Right.
So how do you set up your collapsibles for success?
I put, depending on the location, normally I'll put 2-pound weights, stand them up in each side.
Each corner.
And you stand them up. I don't lay them down. I stand them up so I can use it as a handle to get that pot in and out of the boat.
Okay, zip tie.
Makes it easier to ground. Yeah. zip time right in there and drop those down. If I, you know, if I were going down, if Nisqually Delta was open and I was going to be down there, those 2-pound weights would be 5-pound weights.
Gotcha.
And I'll put that in. And then if I'm going to start leaving the pot overnight or for longer soaks, that's when I'll bring one in that's got a ramp. And I'll put the ramp pot.
So by a ramp, you're talking now, instead of just a flat side where those crab can walk in, you're talking about an entry tunnel.
I'm talking an entry tunnel and a ramp that they actually walk up and drop.
So now that it's not just a door that falls behind that crab, that crab walks in this tunnel, drops down a level.
Right.
So and now he's got a tougher time getting back out of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's when you can get a whole bunch of crab in a pot. Okay.
Right.
All right. So now you're not taking a single zip tie or bait pin and putting a turkey leg in the middle of that thing and not protecting it beyond that. Tell us about your bait setup in the middle of that pot and how you make sure they can't get it all in one sitting.
You center it in the pot. You stand the bait cage on end.
Okay, so you're using a bait cage.
You're using a bait cage.
You stand it on end. You zip tie it to the bottom with an open end up.
Right.
The same way you open up the pot.
Right. Okay. And there's enough room between the surface of that pot, the top of that pot, and that bait cage that they can't sit on top and freeload in your pot.
Gotcha.
They got to get inside.
So you also, you're mindful of the swing of those doors.
Right.
So they can't get hooked up on the bait.
They can't get hooked up on it. And then you can put, so you've got a bait in that cage that they continually can pick at, but yet they can't really get in there and rip it apart and demolish it instantly. And then you got something in there for scent that's going to bring them to the pot. And then you got a bait bag or a hanging bait that they can really get in and have some success, get their teeth chattering in that pot to call the other ones in and get it going. And
I think
a trick.
That's one of the most underrated aspects of bringing a whole bunch of crab into a pot is having crab in there that are making the sounds and smells and vibrations of a Dungeness eating frenzy going on.
A Dungeness eating is just like a pair of scissors, a good sharp scissors that are brand new that you open and close and you can hear that. That's what their teeth are. That's what their chompers are like when they're cutting on that, and they can hear each other.
And they have short little digestive tracts.
Yeah.
Right? So the minute something comes in the indoor, eggs, there's and so it's that those feeding pheromones and everything else that's going on coming out of them that's going to attract a whole bunch of other crab. All right, now, so the amount of crab that you get in your pot is a function of the soak time, right?
Mm-hmm. Soak time and location is key.
Okay.
Yeah, and you will. I mean, we've had days over there in some spots where we, you know, you drop those six pots and the first one's got two, three, a couple of rock crab, you're too shallow. And then all of a sudden you get to that third or fourth pot and there's 20 keepers in it and then a 45-minute drop. And you're thinking to yourself, holy smokes, there's the spot.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, you settle out and you pick that seven, maybe you're at the 70 or 90-foot range and you separate your gear out and get it going down the shoreline.
So you've heard us, if anybody listening to the show has heard us talk about the crustacean coiler, the SMI crustacean coiler. So when you're going out for that day on Tuesday, you're using a 400-foot spool and four 100-foot shots of line, sea link together. Tell me about your line length. And
we'll actually have one of the coils will have six 100s on it.
600s. Okay.
And then we'll have a smaller one that will have 650s on it.
Really?
So if we're going to be at 50 foot, we can use 50 footers.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to be at 70 foot, we can use 100 footers. If we've got to go to 120, we can add a 50 C-linked onto that 100. So we're ready to go. We're locked and loaded, and you keep the 100s on one and the 50s on another, and you add as needed.
And if somebody's going out and wants some Christmas crab or Thanksgiving crab or stuff like that, I mean, you kind of need to throw away your summertime habits. I mean, you don't need to go soak that thing in 200 feet of water. You don't need to eat, you know, especially right now with what's just come down the rivers.
Yeah.
And also, before you go running your boat in Puget Sound, too, you better have full daylight.
Yeah, full daylight. And keep in mind,
there's a bunch of drift in the bay right now.
Keep in mind, with all this drift, it grabs your pot float and moves it around.
You know,
a lot of us like to say, oh, my, I had nothing in my pot, and it was moved. Somebody lifted it up and pulled it and took the stuff. When, in fact, what happened is a nice log grabbed a hold of it and dragged it 50 feet down the beach, scared all the crabs away. And it didn't fish good for a while because of the movement on it, of that log going up and down and bouncing that pot around for 12 hours.
So the weight in that pot not only keeps it in the same position so you can find it, but also stabilizes that pot for its inhabitants.
Exactly. Yeah. It makes it a very comfortable. I mean, none of us want to eat in a restaurant that's bouncing up and down.
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah.
All right. What's going on in the squid front in the Sound?
Squid front. We are seeing a lot more squid in that 90 to 70 foot range, especially on these high tides that are coming up. You're going to see them down in Area 11 where I'm.
Okay. You're boating for them.
We'd be boating for them, yes. And we're seeing a lot more down there, and it's time, I think. It's just about going to be peak time here coming up this next set of tides. You're going to have high tides in the morning, and there's guys down there in that Les Davis Pier now. I guarantee you they're pounding them on this high tide. And then you got the high tide in the evening, too. And that 2 hours before that high, these things, you know, they migrate in from 130, 100 feet out there, and they start getting into the 70-foot range and the 40-foot range.
And this is an afternoon drill for you,
Brett. It's just before dusk drill. Gotcha. So I like to see, a high tide at 3 o'clock to 6 o'clock range.
Are you using lights?
No.
You really don't.
Lights. I've got lights on the boat. I can hit a switch and do it, but prefer to go during the day, and you get all you need. I mean,
are you marking them on the Raymarine before you're dropping gear? Okay, so you're motoring around and looking for squid on the Sound.
I'm fine. I'm trying to get it. If you can get on them when you got a drift, I don't drop a hook on them. I don't drop an anchor, but I will find that cloud, and if it seems to be that they're pretty consistent 70-foot spot, I'll drift that 70-foot line and do just fine getting them.
And so tell us about the rig. You got a weight on the bottom.
You got a cannonball on the bottom. Yeah. You got 3 to 4 unweighted jigs. I think 4 is the max you can have legally.
Otori.
Yeah.
How far from the ball to the first jig?
8 inches.
Oh, really?
Putting them all 8 inches apart. Yeah, you're trying to.
A salmon jigging rod.
Yeah, for example. Salmon jigging rod. And, you know, the cannonball would be at the hook keeper, and the last jig would be at the tip of the rod. And separate things out nice and easy and just settle it down into that cloud and just hang on.
So you get your crabs cooked, you know, get some crabs cracking, and then you get some calamari right there.
Yeah.
You don't need turkey at that point.
No.
Dude, that sounds so good. I mean, we're actually got, some family that's going to be around on Friday, right? And I was talking to Kathy about it. And, you know, all right, well, what do we, you know, you got to serve something for these folks that are coming over. And, well, we have some leftover turkey. Don't even say leftover turkey to me on Friday. Yeah, we're gonna have some crab. I'm gonna get some of that crab gear in the water. All right, coming up next, I tell you what, we need to stave off the green monster a little bit, which is corrosion on your boat. Okay, if you don't take a few steps to winterize your boat, you can either pay little bill right now or you can pay big bill on down the line. Right. We mentioned a little bit earlier the Pacific Marine Expo. Our good friend Lauren Bivens, a Harbor Marine, is going to talk to us a little bit about winterizing and off-season accessorizing. And I tell you what, there's a couple new products he's got his eye on, too, that are going to definitely help you out. The Northwest Outdoor Report, and then our buddy Kelly Reardon, in the Hood Canal area, is going to talk about that Hood Canal chum run, some techniques for that particular deal. Do not turn your nose up at fresh smoked chum salmon. Dude,
there's nothing wrong with
it. They're fun to catch. And for those out-of-town guests,
they don't
know the difference.
Send them home with some.
Yeah, that's it, too. The Black Friday fishing event. Roy Robbins is really wearing a whole lot more. Stay tuned for jam-packed hour 2 of the Outdoor Line. 710 ESPN, Seattle.